So our reading today is Psalm 25, verses 1 to 10. And Norman has asked for it to be in the New Living Translation. O Lord, I give my life to you. I trust in you, my God. Do not let me be disgraced, or let my enemies rejoice in my defeat. No one who trusts in you will ever be disgraced, but disgrace comes to those who try to deceive others. Show me the right path, O Lord. Point out the road for me to follow. Lead me by your truth and teach me, for you are the God who saves me. All day long I put my hope in you. Remember, O Lord, your compassion and unfailing love, which you have shown from long ages past. Do not remember the rebellious sins of my youth. Remember me in the light of your unfailing love, for you are merciful, O Lord. The Lord is good and does what is right. He shows the proper path to those who go astray. He leads the humble in doing right, teaching them his way. The Lord leads with unfailing love and faithfulness all who keep his covenant and obey his commands.
Shall we just briefly pray? May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Psalm 25. I feel like we've had a good run through all this. I don't need to say very much. The whole service, Heather's packaged it beautifully. That Graham Kendrick thing, I'm going to have that on repeat on my phone. I should be playing that to myself quite often. It's a wonderful way of expressing psalms. Psalms, of course, are poems and songs. And I think that's why they are still so popular. They were written a long, long, long time ago, but they still resonate with us because we like songs, we like to sing, to rejoice, we like poems. We may think, oh, I don't like poetry, but when you hear a good poem, you do, you respond to a good poem. These things become part of our fabric. And yet they are ages and ages away since somebody wrote them down. Somebody first sang, but they would have been sung. We've lost the tunes. Some churches today, Anglican churches in particular, love to sing psalms. I know when we first came to Reading, the church down on the old Oxford Road on the corner of Wayland Street, the old Oxford Road Methodist, they sang a psalm every service. And, you know, just the words, but you sing the bits appropriately. It fits in with the phrasing of the music. And if you've got somebody good on the organ, it's terrific. It's really good. It grabs hold of your spirit. And that is why these things have lasted for so long. A lot of them are attributed to David, King David. He can't have written all of them. There's 150 of them. And it took 700 years for all of them to be written. There's a span of 700 years. He might have written the first few, and this may well be one of them, because I just have a feeling it has something of David and his life about it. So for today, David wrote this one, okay? Scholars may disagree, but today David wrote this one. They took a long time to write and to think about and to be accepted and taken into the lives and the spiritual lives of other people. But we do know that by 200 BC, 200 years before Jesus was born, the collection that we have now was pretty much together. And people have been using them and rejoicing in them ever since. We all know bits of Psalms that we can quote. I lift up mine eyes unto the hills. My help cometh. We can do that because they're soaked into us. They're part of the fabric. Because they were written by ordinary people in ordinary circumstances. And that's what we are. We're ordinary people in ordinary circumstances. We're people who are alive in God. This one I can relate to because it speaks of somebody whose life is intention, shall we say, in parts. There are difficulties, there are enemies who seek to defeat him, to disgrace him. And he asked the Lord not to let him be disgraced or to let him be defeated. He feels people pulling around him. And if it was David that wrote this, you can imagine being king, there'd be all sorts of tensions. And people would be trying to rubbish him, to bring him down, to overthrow him, to diminish him. Say, oh, well, look, he used to dance in the streets. You know what he was like? He's a terrible bloke. Why should he be king? My mate over here, he's a much better king. Let's have him instead. All that sort of intrigue and stuff all going on all the time. Part of an ordinary life, if you happen to be the king. So he's got all of that. And I can relate to this because I've been in situations where everything's in tension, everything's difficult around you. Today happens to be a special day for Barbara and I because it's an anniversary. It's the 45th anniversary, not of our getting married, we did that a bit earlier. The 45th anniversary of our first full day in Reading. It just happened to have been in 1977... that the 10th of July fell on a Sunday. We arrived in Reading on the Saturday, the 9th. We took about three goes at arriving in Reading because we had a very small van, which was all we could afford to hire, for one day. So we came with one lot of stuff and took it to the flat that we had in Caroline Court on the Bath Road. And we lived there for about 6 or 7 months. We brought all our stuff, or some of our stuff, the first time with a friend of ours from where we were working. Went back to the east end of London, to Stepney, came back again with another load, and then we had to take the van back because we didn't want to lose the deposit. So drive all the way back. I've never been up and down the M4 so many times in one day. And then put whatever we had left in the car and came back again. Finally arriving, I don't know what time, on Saturday night. So Sunday was our first full day and we were at leisure. We could just look out the window and see the sunshine. And we thought we'd arrived in some kind of paradise. Well, I mean, Reading, you would, wouldn't you? You would. We thought we'd come for 2 or 3 years and 45 years later. I don't know where that plan went. But here we are. And I've been coming to this place. We were working out at the last trustees meeting for 20-some-odd years. I think 22, 23 years. So I always say when I come here, I feel like I am coming home. You know, I've been, I remember two trips to Spring Harvest and the weekend away to Exmouth when Tom led us and spoke to us and gave us great blessing. And they had a pool and we went swimming and that was all good as well. So I've been around, I've been part of all this and it's been great, been lovely. But where we came from, in Stepney, in the East End of London, I was on the staff, the lay staff, of the Methodist East End Mission on the Commercial Road. And I was the caretaker and hostel warden, which sounds very glad. I cleaned the toilets. I mended the toilets. I got quite good at plumbing. I unblocked things that you don't want to think about. I had to keep the place clean and tidy. There were 125, 130 people living in the building, and I had to keep them clean and safe and secure. And it was my first job out of college, and a degree in chemistry was no use whatsoever. I got hold of the Reader's Digest do-it-yourself manual, which taught me everything I now know about woodwork, mending things and whatever else, how to sharpen tools and what tools to buy, indeed. and how to hold them and all those sort of things, and I got on with that job. But it was hard work. One of the main duties of the mission at that time was a mission to homeless tubercular alcoholics, which is about the bottom of society. They weren't just homeless in London. I mean, a lot of them ex-servicemen, as they still are, regrettably. They were alcoholic. They drank cider laced with meths, because that was the cheapest way to get drunk. And many of them had TB as well. All the staff had to have had their TB jab to be able to work there. I didn't have too much to do with that side of it, but they did come and bang on my door occasionally. And the mission had a rule that you did not give anybody money, because you knew what would happen to it. So we would give them food, we would take them for a meal, we would do whatever we could, but no money was ever to be given. And I remember one day somebody banged on my door and said, "Oh, my wife's very ill and we've got no food in the house and it's all very terrible. What can you do for me?" And I said, "Wait there." And I went into the kitchen and I got a carrier bag and I loaded it with everything I could find out of the kitchen. And I handed it to this person who was really hoping I would give him money for booze. And I didn't learn some new words. I come from a mining community. I knew most of the words. But I heard them afresh in a different dialect, a different tone. It was not a happy job in a lot of ways, although it was fulfilling in other ways. Everybody who worked there were 8, I think, full-time staff, all lived on the premises. You were on duty 24 hours, 6 days a week, so you got one day off. And by the time I came away after 2 years, I was a bit frazzled by the time I arrived in Reading. We had a doorbell on our flat which rang continuously. People would just lean on it. It was one of those doorbells that rang until you took your finger off. And I said, when we came to Reading, "I am never, ever having a doorbell again." We have one, actually, now, but it just goes ding-dong and then shuts up. I can cope with that now, but it was a lot of years before I would consent to have a doorbell. But one of the staff there was a deaconess, which is a weird thing that we used to have in the Methodist Church, an order of ladies who were almost like nuns, who did pastoral stuff alongside the ordained staff. And the lady at that time, the deaconess, was a lady in her 60s who'd been sent from South Wales to the East End Mission by the church. They just decided that for some reason she needed to be in the East End Mission. Well, she did, because she was good. But she found it very hard. And she said to me one day, "This job has taught me to live on the promises of God." And nobody had ever said that to me before, or anything like that. As she said, "It's taught me to live on those promises." And it was quite a while before I actually really understood that. I think I do now. I think I've got the gist. But at the time, that was a revelation, that she had little else but the fact that God had said, "It will be all right. You will come through. You will come out the other side. I am there for you." And it bore her up every day. And she did a magnificent job. She was a lovely lady. And eventually she did retire back to South Wales. And she was, I'm sure, I had many happy years back in her home church. But for that period in the East End, she did a lot of good to a lot of people. But she herself felt very battered and bashed and bruised by what was going on. So I can relate to a situation like the psalmist was in, where stuff's coming at you from all sides. The East End at the time had just been laid waste because the docks had closed and they'd literally flattened them. They were just foundations. You could see where all the warehouses had been, the big open rectangular ponds of water where they brought the boats in to be loaded and unloaded. They were still there. There were huge signs everywhere saying that the Docklands Development Corporation are going to do something. Nobody knew what. But they'd had their livelihood taken away. The whole community had been ripped apart because the docks had been the centre of their life for generation after generation. And it had gone. Just gone. literally been wiped off the face of the earth. And the people there didn't really know what they were doing, and it was not a comfortable or happy place to be. But life has moved on, and 45 years later, it's quite a smart part of the world. A lot of people want to go and live there. And I hope that the people who have always lived there have been able to find a new way of being and a new way of doing, and have resigned themselves to the fact the docks ain't coming back. But through all that, God has been with them, and God was with the psalmist. And with everyone who wrote, we don't know how many people wrote the 150 psalms. There might have been little gangs of them wrote one of them, we don't know. But with all of them, God has been with them. And I think that's, it gives me a buzz when I think about that. When David was on the throne, he could look back 1,000 years to when Abraham was called to travel to Canaan. The family had already moved out of Ur. His father had done that. They'd only got about like 25 miles or something and then stopped. They didn't go very far, but God said, I'm going to make a great nation from you. What a promise that is. All the families in the earth will be blessed through you. But you must do this for me. You must go where I tell you to go. You must do what I tell you to do. But I will make that promise. So David could look back on 1,000 years. Look forward 1,000 years from David, and you're talking about Jesus. And in that 1,000 years between David and Jesus, the kingdom split into two. Most of them were carried away by the Assyrians into exile. The temple was laid waste. All kinds of horrible things happened. But then a remnant were allowed to come back. King Cyrus let one or two people come back to start rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. And by the time Jesus was a lad of 12, he could go to the temple again in Jerusalem and get lost talking to the scholars and the priests. And then 2,000 years on, and here we are in Southcote this morning. 4,000 years of God saying, I will look after you. How many times have we had the word faithfulness this morning? Dave mentioned it right off the bat before we'd even got properly started, but he was just trying to shut us all up and keep us quiet, which is no bad thing at the start of a service. We've been doing that for some years. Some churches light a candle 5 minutes before. When the candle's lit, it's a good thing just to calm yourself down. But faithfulness. God is faithful. And you're in a situation now where you're thinking about a big step. Something new. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't know who's going to come. But I tell you this. God knows what you want. He also knows what you need. And how often are they not the same? But it doesn't matter, because God says, I will give you what you need, and I will give it to you at the right time. And he does. When I came to Reading, I was a fresh-faced young man of just 25. 45 years later, well, there's a lot more of me than there used to be. I was a very skinny bloke when I arrived, but 3 weeks ago I celebrated my 70th birthday, which I can't quite believe, but there you go. But in those 70 years, I've been around a bit, I've seen a few things, I've seen different situations, I've been in situations, as I say, of tension, and always things have come right, but in God's good time. Patience, they say, is a virtue. If you're one of God's people, it's an absolute necessity. You've got to sit and wait. Pray. Think about what you want, what direction you want to go in, what kind of person you want. All of those good questions. Do it prayerfully. God is with you in that process. God will not let you down. Show me the right path, O Lord. Point out the road for me to follow. God can only do that pointing out if you're actually listening. During the time I was at the mission, they had every evening we had a prayer session at bedtime, about 9:30 of an evening. We would gather just for a few minutes, all the residents who wanted to come, which was a lovely thing. But there was one young chap, one of the students who was working at the mission, and the word just was in every line several times usually. Lord, I just want to do this. I just want to do that. I just want to tell you this. And he wasn't listening. He was just churning it out. He wasn't stopping to reflect and to listen. He wasn't waiting for God to answer back. And one evening, as we walked out of prayers, I said to him, if you say just one more time, I should kick your ankle. Which was not a very Christian thing to say. And I would not recommend it. But he stopped using the word just, and he started to think about what he was praying. And his prayers stretched out, not in words, but in time. He'd say something, and then there'd be a pause to reflect. It helped all the people around him. You need to do that. When you are praying, don't just say, oh God, I'm so worried about this. We haven't got a pastor, and we haven't got this, and we haven't got the other, and oh, it's all terrible, and we're all getting older, and there's not many of us, and oh, blah, blah, blah. Oh, never mind, never mind. Listen to God who is faithful. God can only point out the road if you listen. It's no good asking somebody for directions. If you're in a strange town, you don't say, can you tell me the way to the high street, please, and then walk away. What's the good of that? You have to stop and listen. That's what God wants you to do. Lead me by your truth. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. The psalmist didn't know about Jesus. David had no conception of Jesus. But he knew the truth about God. And the truth of God was his faithfulness. God is there for you. God is listening. God will speak to you. But you've got to use these, or the mental equivalent thereof. Be ready for God. Be prayerfully ready. Because God will be faithful. I'm sure there are great things going to happen in this place. Great things have happened here. There's no reason why they should suddenly stop. God's relationship with man has rolled on in a form that we've recorded and we've read and we know about for 4,000 years. It's not about to stop. God is with you in your plans, in your thoughts, in your wishes, in your dreams, if you like, and in the inevitable waiting. God is with you. God is faithful. The last verse of the psalm, the Lord leads with unfailing love and faithfulness all who keep his covenant and obey his demands. Do that. The Lord will be with you with unfailing love and faithfulness. Yeah. We know that. Let's remember it. God bless you all.